Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RM Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show. Hello, and welcome back to Fighting on Film. This week we have a very, very, very special occasion where we might actually finally do some chivalry and swords.
Woohoo! Yeah! Patrons in the background. Finally! Woohoo!
Everyone, we've received some like DMs and messages on various social media platforms going, when are you going to do some swords and chivalry?
We're getting hounded. We have
we are very seen on this issue, so yeah. You know, very pleased to finally get a film of
our
this
first look. One. Yeah,
and massive thanks to the patrons who, the supporting cast who voted for this one over Guadalcanal, The Real Glory. What was that other one?
April Morning
that I chose. That yeah.
Yeah,
some really good stuff there, but we've been talking about doing Ironclad for a while, and every time we talk about what are we going to do for medieval chivalry swords, what are we going to do, this one always comes up, and it's, you know, in classic FOF style, it's a last stand film.
Well, hey, we finally
do a chivalry and sword movie, and it's a last stand film.
Of course, because who doesn't love a siege?
Yeah.
And this film is definitely a siege on the senses.
There's plenty of gore, that's for sure.
Oh, Christ, yeah. It's gratuitous at times.
It is. We'll talk about more about that in a little bit.
Definitely.
I'll lead off. I'll cover production, and then you can jump into cast, Rob, if that works for you.
Yeah, no problem. Go ahead, mate.
So, directed by Jonathan English. It was released in 2011, but it was actually filmed way back in 2009. So had a little bit of an interval between filming and release, no doubt because, you know, post-production. A lot of CGI, yep. We'll talk about that as well. Jonathan English, best known for this film, basically. He'd worked on Minotaur in 2006. And then in 2014, he did the sequel to this film, which follows like a survivor from the siege has to defend his village from some Celtic raiders.
Who? there wasn't many survivors.
Yeah, I'm going to guess it's the Squire because James Purfoy doesn't come back. So I don't know.
All right, fair
no one
enough,
comes
then,
back.
Yeah.
Come back.
Maybe we'll do that sometime down the line.
Yeah.
I'm glad too.
It's Kate Mara defending a village.
Kate Mara just recasted her as someone completely different.
Yeah. Yeah. English is probably, you know, most successful in terms of he's a prolific producer. He's worked on all sorts of things over the last 20 years. Most recently, some of his TV stuff has included SEAL Team, The Ark, and The Outpost. So wow. Some fairly prominent series there. The screenplay was devised by English and Eric Castell and Stephen McDool. And essentially, I read an interview with him on Patch.com where he talks about, you know, the impetus for making the film. Mm. And he says, I think before I'd even left the building, I assume he means either the castle or the gift shop, I'd already had one of those moments where you go, wow, that would make a really good movie. Apparently he visited Rochester Castle, learned a little bit about, you know, its amazing history in terms of the siege. And we'll give a bit of historical context on that in a moment. But rightly so, he thought that would make a great movie. And he went away and started working on a script and gathered a huge team of producers and financiers with about 20, 25 people attached to the project.
A lot of people to get this one over the line. Yeah,
a lot of moving parts for sure. About a £20 million budget. And it was entirely filmed.
That's quite, it's good.
That is fair.
Like independent production. That is, it's not bad.
And in places you can definitely see that money. And in casting, you can definitely see that money.
Yeah. Well, I think that's where a lot of the money might have gone.
Yeah. Entirely shot in Wales. An impressive replica of the actual castle was built. Mm-hmm. So the production designer, Joseph Nemec, said the team carried out like very extensive research into the architecture of the period, but they didn't choose to remain strictly true to, you know, the style in every aspect. He said, we discovered that all castles were covered in plaster and painted with a lime wash. So they all had white interior rooms, which is fascinating from a research point of view. But we realized that if we did that, it would look like The Princess Diaries. But we're making a movie about brutal medieval battles. So clearly the Nemec has gone away and thought, well, if we just paint everywhere white as it would have been, you know, looking brand spanking new, people are going to be disconnected from what they've seen walking around castles and stuff and seeing photos.
It might have been a fucker to light as well.
Yeah. I mean, you can see they were struggling in some places with those interior shots. Some of those interior shots, such as like the Archbishop visit Charles Dance, was filmed at Tree Tower Manor in Wales, and then St. Donat's Castle in the Vale of Glamorgan was used for a number of shots, and a lot of it was filmed in a field near Pencoed. And the castle was there for a couple of years afterwards. So essentially what they did was they built this giant like external model of the front of the keep, the famous, you know, front sort of like steps and gate and that corner that spoilers comes down, and a little bit of bailey.
No, you've ruined it. Oh.
I know. Sorry, everyone. It only happened in 1215, Rob. So, you know, people have had
spoiler
time.
Spoiler alert, people. It's a long time.
So basically, they made it all out of wood scaffolding, plastic, and sheet metal. And it looks like, I've seen some behind-the-scenes photographs and people have gone for set visits and stuff, and it looks really incredible.
It's good.
One guy that visited
bits
said,
of it dotted around like the Berlin Wall. People have got bits of it.
Yeah, I bet.
Little chunks.
Like someone's garden. Like just a, a step
like a
from Rochester
Cullis.
Castle.
Someone's man cave.
This is from the 2009 film Ironclad. liberated this from the set.
Someone's actually garage.
Keeps the missus out anyway.
Keep the Ford Fiesta in there. Portcullis keeps it safe.
I love it. That'd be peak man cave.
That'd be cool.
Memorabilia. So it looks really impressive. The people that visited the set talk about, like, you can get within arm's distance, and then you start to see that it's painted and stuff and not quite real. But it sounds really impressive, and the scale of it is definitely impressive.
It's good.
Cinematography was by David Egby, who cut his teeth on the original Mad Max, which is quite impressive. Lots of films, Quigley Down Under, which is a personal fave. It's like a cowboy film set in Australia in the 1800s. Wild.
Nice.
And then the music was by Lorne Balf, who has worked on a huge plethora of films, some that we've already covered. Films including 12 Strong, 13 Hours, Terminator Genesis, the most recent Mission Impossible films, and the Churchill film that Brian Cox did, which was terrible.
We'll talk about that in a minute, interestingly enough.
Good, good. The Tomorrow War and Top Gun Maverick as well. He's done some really impressive scoring.
I don't mean to tangent, but I remember that film being odd because it was just Churchill being worried about D-Day.
Yeah, it was like someone had written a film about Churchill without doing any reading about Churchill.
Yeah. Just Brian Cox being like, but what if the boys get killed on the beaches? It's like...
Yeah, what? Yeah. I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to they tried to draw like Gallipoli parallels and stuff, didn't they? But I that's not where Churchill was at that.
And they like made out that him and Kitty didn't get along in places. Yeah. And I'm like, they really liked each other. Like they were happily married. Like what? Okay.
The CGI, which I mentioned a little earlier, but it's relatively impressive for 2009-2011 standards, was done by a company called Lola, and they did about 20 shots for the movie. Including several like digital matte paintings, like just still backgrounds, army and trebuchet replication, and CG castles and bridges and cathedrals.
Yeah, that holds up. I've got to admit, it's fine. Does. There's nothing wrong with it.
We'll probably talk about it towards the end of the show, but the scene where spoilers, the corner of the castle collapses is actually quite good.
It's not bad. Looking at it for too long, it's a bit ropey.
Yeah,
like it's all right
for that. For 2011.
Yeah, for an independent, what essentially is an independent film. Mm. Like, it's good.
Absolutely. And I think that basically rounds it out for production.
Cool. So, we'll do cast, and then I've got a one-word review. I've got the one-word reviews, and then I've got a retro review. So, kicking off the cast. So, I've got down here that it's a really interesting mix of British character actors and one American well-respected character actor.
Oh my god, it's like the 50s.
It really is. Yeah. So apparently, much of the original casting ideas were canned. Kate Mara was one of the ones that was like originally attached. And then they had to change a lot of the casting. But we don't know who those original people were. Because apparently, I think at one stage, I did some research about the production as well. It seems like there was a much grander film planned, and then the financing had to be all rejigged around. So, actors had to either pulled out through scheduling or they couldn't afford them anymore. Mm-hmm. But the cast that you get is not too shabby. So we have James Purfoy as Marshall. He's a Knights Templar and a former Crusader. Early credits include A Knight's Tale, played King George in the Churchill 2017 film that also starred Brian Cox.
Great film.
Yeah. Solomon Kane. TV roles include HBO's Rome, Sharp Sword, The Hollow Crown, and most recently Sex Education. I know Matt has seen some of that one.
I have, yeah. He's pretty good in that.
Okay, fair enough. But I haven't watched it. We've got Brian Cox, aforementioned, as Baron Albany. He's an Emmy Award-winning, Laurence and Olivier Award-winning, Golden Globe winner, a Scottish actor. He's found fame most recently as Logan Roy in Succession. Yeah. I think that's really...
real resurgence for him.
Longevity in his career now. I think we're going to remember him for a long time.
He was also in Sharp.
Already. He was also in Sharp. No, I don't know Sharp very well, so alas. So he was in Jersey Churchill 2017, mention it again. Other notable roles include Wes Anderson's Rushmore and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Yeah. He was also in Rob Roy in Braveheart. And he also played Hermann Göring in the 2001 TV film Nuremberg. And the likeness is actually really uncanny, I think.
I remember that, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's Alec Baldwin in that one, I think, as well. Or it might be Billy Baldwin. One of the Baldwins. Sir Derek Jacobi, his powerhouse is coming out the back.
Right? I know.
Coming out. Sir Derek Jacobi is Reginald de Cornhill, the Lord of the Castle, Rochester Castle. He's a BAFTA, Olivier, Tony Award, Emmy winner. Known for his roles in 1970s I, Claudius, The Odessa File, Day of the Jackal, Gladiator, Two Men Went to War, which we should do. It's quite an interesting war film. King's Speech. And he also played Hitler in a 1982 TV film called Inside the Third Reich.
No way.
He did, yeah.
Did not know that.
And he played Stanley Baldwin in The Gathering Storm in 2002. So there's a interesting Churchill
I remember that, yeah.
Through line, yeah, I remember that being quite good. Then we have Kate Mara as Isabel, Cornhill's wife. She's an American actress. She's been in House of Cards, Shooter, the 2015 Fantastic Four reboot, The Martian, and most recently an episode of one of the latest series of Black Mirror.
Yeah. She gets pushed in front of a train in House of Cards, if I remember rightly.
I wouldn't know.
Spoilers for anyone there. I've really probably fucked that for someone.
I only like the original British series, so I'm a bit of a purist when it comes to that.
it's not bad.
No, it's all right, but the
I haven't watched the last season because of
the BBC trilogy is peak, top notch, absolutely. Then we have Paul Giamatti as King John. He's an Oscar nominee. He won that for his appearance as Joe Gould in 2005's Cinderella Man. He also appeared in Sideways, the film about wine. Shoot 'Em Up, 12 Years a Slave, straight off Compton. He won a Golden Globe and an Emmy for his role as John Adams in the HBO series of the same name, which I think flew under the radar here a little bit.
It did, yeah. I think not enough people knew who John Adams was for it to really hit, you know?
Mm, yeah.
Although you could say that about Hamilton too, but Hamilton's a phenomena.
Yeah, exactly. But he might be best known to the Foth faithful for his cameo role in Saving Private Ryan as the paratrooper sergeant who knocks down the wall of the cafe after trying to get the stone out of his boot. That's what I love seeing him in that. He's like, that's your friendly neighborhood morale officer. The Statue of Liberty is kaput. I didn't know that.
He does a really good American accent for being a Brit.
It fluctuates, but it stays there. It's all right.
There's some ADR in there, though. You've got to admit. Like, you spotted it instantly.
Definite ADR, because it's very light.
What's ADR for the listeners, Rob, if they haven't heard us going about that before?
Post-recorded sound. So you re-record your lines over the footage. It's quite common. I think most movies do it naturally anyway now. It's just a formality.
Yeah, it's kind of goes alongside Foley stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Because obviously, when you're shooting, there's wind and all things like that. I've done short films where we had to ADR the entire thing. Because all the on location sound recorded was just gash because there was wind. There's nothing you can do. Moving on, we have Jason Fleming as Beckett, one of Albany's mercs. He's another British character actor, prolific. He's known for his early roles in Lock, Stock, and Two.
Oh, God, this could have been a Merc Month film, Rob.
It could have been. We've missed
an opportunity there.
Yeah. So he's in Lock, Stock, Two Smoking Barrels, Snatch. He played Dr. Jekyll and Hyde in 2003's League of Gentlemen, which younger Robbie absolutely loved.
It was good. I don't know why everyone hates on it. Like, it was fine.
It's fun. It's a comic book film, which feels like a comic book film before they corporatized. They hit, he's also in Rob Roy, another connection. Mean Machine, the World War II horror film The Bunker, which, you know, if you're in the tunnels of Foth HQ, you might have heard smatterings about that maybe being our Halloween film this year. So stay tuned for that one. Jason, if you're listening, join us for that. We'd love to have you on. And he's also in X-Men. And one for Matt, actually, a role that I thought you might like if you don't know about it already. He played Quatermass in the 2005 remake of Quatermass and The Experiment.
Oh, yeah. The sort of like modern revamp of it.
The one with Mark Gatiss.
Yeah, it was pretty good, actually.
I watched that at the time. I liked it.
Yeah. Was he in Churchill 2017?
He wasn't, unfortunately, no.
Oh, shame, no. The film.
Matt's gaslighting everyone about this Churchill movie this week. I can't control him when he's like this, folks. He was also in the alternative history drama SSGB, which I thought was woefully underwhelming. Considering
that was a missed opportunity.
Matter, it really was, yeah. And most recently, he appeared in the Sky crime drama A Town Called Malice. Then we have Jamie Foreman, whose credits include roles in Gary Oldman's Kneel by Mouth. It's one of my all-time favourite films. It's just horrifically superb. ID, lots of Nick Love, sort of hooligan-y type movies, like Football Factory, Goodbye Charlie Bright. He also appears in Layer Cake. He's such like a, you want like a domineering,
what an imposing guy
type. Yeah. It's Jamie Foreman. I've met him at a convention. Lovely guy.
That's cool.
But he's also been in a couple of military things in the 70s and 80s. So he was in Wings in 1978 and Squadron in 1982, which is like a fictional show about a fighter squadron.
Squadron. Exactly.
And he also played Derek Branning in EastEnders from 2011 to 2012. Prolific guy. He's been in so much. And then we have Anurin Bernard as Guy, who's Albany Squire. He was in Dunkirk 2017. He played Mozart in Interlude in Prague. Bitter Harvest. TV roles include Peaky Blinders. He was in SSGB and War and Peace and the Netflix 1899 thing that they canned the minute it did poorly, if you remember that.
1899, which one's that? Is that the Yellowstone spin-off thing? Oh, yeah. No, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and they canned it.
I watched it, and that must be where I recognize his face from, because I watched it all. And I was like, this is okay, because it was based on the same production team as Dark. Which is a really good German series that was quite cool, set in the '80s in like West Germany. But
it's a shame.
Yeah.
We need to stop big companies just killing things because it doesn't get an immediate audience. That's not how media works.
Exactly.
Because if that happened, there'd be no YouTubers. There'd be no nothing like that.
You know, getting immediate,
you know, it's not how it works. Anyway.
You've given up long ago.
Oh god, yeah. Mackenzie Crook stars as Marks. He's an archer. A little bit Legolas-y type character in there, I feel. Mm-hmm. Like that's who they were championing here.
A lot of the same pickup shot there as well.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. So he's in Pirates of the Caribbean. He's in BBC Four's excellent comedy series, The Detectorists. He was Gareth in The Office. He was also in Churchill, The Hollywood Years, that we need to cover because that's a funny film.
Oh, it's not as good as the 2017 Churchill, though, is it?
Oh my god, amazing. And he also played Wurzel Gummidge in the 2019 remake, and he was in Game of Thrones. So another prolific character actor. He looked quite good in the promotional images I saw of Wurzel Gummidge. I was like, that's a good casting. Then we have Rhys Parry Jones as Wolfstan. He's another one of the Mercs. The most interesting credit he plays, and he's quite a big guy in there, powerful looking chap, big bear of a man. He played John Le Mesuré in 2018's A Very British Scandal.
What?
And I just couldn't see it. But
he slim down that much?
I don't know. Maybe he lost a load of weight.
Like,
I've no idea.
You can lose a lot of weight, but you can still be broad.
I know.
Le Mesuré is known for being like.
I'm going to track down some scenes. Imposing much. And the first time we've ever mentioned this on the show, so I had to get it in there. He provides the Welsh dub, language dub, of the voices of Patrick and Mr. Krabs in the S4C SpongeBob SquarePants dubs.
That is incredible trivia. That is the only time that will ever be mentioned on a war movie podcast, and I'm so here for it. Amazing. I need to go and find that now.
Me money. Absolutely love Mr. Krabs.
Whatever he says, whatever it is for Welsh.
I live in Wales, but I cannot speak Welsh. The Paris dogs. Then we have Vladimir Kulich as Tiberius, the leader of King John's Danish mercenaries. Mercenary film. How could we have missed this?
Oh, jeez.
He's a Czech
actor. We really fucked it on this one.
We haven't dropped the ball. We've dropped the axe at the peak moment. 13th Warrior, Smoking Aces, The Equalizer, the Denzel Washington version, not the superior Ed Woodward version.
Naturally.
TV roles include MacGyver, Angel, The X-Files, and Vikings, because the guy's got form for playing Viking-type guys.
You do.
And finally, rounding out the cast, we have Charles Dance, another British powerhouse.
Amazing. And he's the narrator, too.
And he's the narrator, too, yeah. As Archbishop Langton, he's been in Michael Collins, Gosford Park, Alien 3, The Imitation Game. He played Lord Mountbatten in The Crown, Last Action Hero, The Kingsman. TV work includes The Professionals, The Professionals, Tales of the Unexpected, Foyle's War, and probably most notably in the pop culture scene, Tywin Lannister in Game of Thrones. So what an amazing cast that this has, really. And we'll talk about them more later, I think, but on paper, that's a very good cast for your, you know, 20 million independent movie.
I was
really impressed. And I'll just segue beautifully into the one-word reviews this week. So as always, we put it out on the Twitter, usually on a Sunday or a Monday before we record. And we always love
film.
At Fighting On Film, do follow us, and we'd love to hear what you guys think. So kicking off, we have Fake History Hunter, a fantastic account on Twitter, if you don't already follow it. And he says, awful. AD Bond went with swords. Paul Hicks goes, great film. Lance Nielsen goes, Fleming. I think Lance is a friend of Jason's, so he's going to champion his mate. And why not? Because Jason's good in this. Brian Williams goes at last, Chivalry of the Swords. Mark Barnes goes with Messi. Tansy Kelly Robinson goes with Purfoy, hot. And she put, my mum learned history about history from this that she didn't know. Knight Irish goes Magna, big letters. Peter Sutherland tags Fake History Hunter in. And Dr. Timothy Simmons goes, is that finally a Chivalry and Swords film? And then I had a couple of messages from on Facebook, one from John Passerini going, I couldn't choose whether to say Chivalry or Swords. So it was a lot of excitement, yeah. But it was great. So, thanks again, guys. Some great feedback there. And now we segue into our retro review. We haven't had one for a while, so I always love digging them up. So we have an Empire review from March 2011, and I'll just read you an excerpt from it now. The blokey medieval mini-epic picks up the chronicle where Ridley Scott dropped it at the end of his Robin Hood, and plunges into the juicy politicking of the Barons' War as a vindictive monarch tries to take back England from upstarts who have made him grant unheard-of liberties to the people. According to Wikipedia, several hundred rebels held out during the siege, but Ironclad slims down the number to a traditional magnificent seven. Like all sieges, this offers moments of choppy terror and excitement, followed by a dull sit-in-and-out staff spots. This still offers enough dismemberments, royal tantrums, and portcullis rammings to make for a lively Saturday night out. So not too unfair.
No.
That's, but also not...
On the level, yeah.
Yeah, not praising it massively, but then not underpraising it either. And we'll see what we think as we go along. So maybe we should segue into the first Alley Tally, where me and Matt, complete novices, roll the Alley Tally jingle and whatever Acast are advertising this week.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's time for Alley Tally on Fighting on Film.
So, Rob, what was your favourite sword in the film?
I like the Smith & Wesson sword, or the Kalashnikov sword. No, are you kidding? So I was looking into this because I admitted I'm a bit of a novice when it comes to like pre-1900 British history. I'm a bit of a, you know, I sort of left all that in Key Stage 3 history and was like, I already like War with Guns, as I sort of stopped. But I was watching, there's a five-piece YouTube series that Lindy Beige did about this movie, and apparently he was meant to be at one stage, was going to be attached to the movie as an advisor, but it didn't happen. So he was pretty scathing, and he was saying like there's inaccuracies in the costumes, like you get the classic, everyone's got like pop studs over them when pop studs didn't exist. People have got like weird like chain links where there isn't anything. There's fiberglass helmets with like paint having been chipped off that they hang around on too much. But I can't pick anything out because I don't really know that much. But I like to see loads of different sort of hand-to-hand weaponry because we rarely get to see it on the film, so on the yeah. show even. So it was a nice change of pace to sort of be fat, dumb and happy watching a movie rather than being like, oh, is that a proper M1 carbine with the non-bayonet lug for 1943? You know, like it was nice not to be able to be going in so hard on a shootout. Is that, yeah. I think that's, yeah.
That's fair.
I have other things to say too, but what did you think?
There are, as you mentioned, some things that are a bit off, like costuming-wise, but you know, there's, at least not everyone's in plate armor, which in 1215 would not be a thing.
That was what I was worried about. That I was like, we're gonna have
plenty of people in gambeson and mail. period sort of helmets, like pot helmets and stuff, is pretty all right.
Yeah.
Purfoy has a long sword, which is correct. Not sure whether it's a hand and a half or two hand or whatever. I'm not entirely sure on that.
It's a long boy.
On that. It is a long boy.
He'd be chopping with that.
There's that great scene where he just like roars clear and then cuts a man in half.
Yeah.
Insane.
So great.
And then there's that scene where he's on a horse and he has a flail, which is pretty cool.
That's like, so stupid, that scene.
I don't know why he did that. Now's the time to get on the horse.
It reminds me of something out of Ned Kelly. He just comes out with a big helmet on.
Yeah.
Starts swinging. Classic British fair. Starts windmilling in when it all looks like everything's going to be lost.
Big dude had a falchion, which was pretty cool. It's a little like weird, funky sword.
I thought it was an Uruk-hai sword from Lord of the Rings. That's what it reminded me of.
Crook had a longbow as the archer. Jason had like a poleaxe
sort of thing.
And then Tiberius, the Dane dude, leader of the mercenaries.
Yeah. Jamie Foreman had like a club. That was cool.
Yeah. It was. And Tiberius, the Dane dude, had a like a battle axe thing, like a rubber axe. Battle axe.
But it's so painfully a rubber axe in shots.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, can we not swap it out for a real one when we're in like a close up?
No, there's no hero model on that one, Rob. Sorry.
It's such a weird thing. Oh my God.
I'm going to talk about it now because why not? I hate the fact that they portray the Danes as like Vikings.
Yeah.
Which would have been fine like 500, 600 years earlier. Ish, but at that point they're all been like Christianized. They're not all running around with, like, long hair.
King John's threatening to Christianize them. They've already been Christianized.
Like, we're gonna I might have promised that, you know, I'd have a word with the Pope and stop him from Christianizing your land, but I didn't
threat to me. Like,
yeah, what a double cross that was, Rob. That scene, I was shook. I really was. I'll talk more about those guys later, I'm sure. Kate Mara's dress. Probably definitely not period correct.
No, probably not.
definitely would have been a bit more covered up. Because all of the manuscripts and illustrations from the period, you see, like, you don't really see like open top dresses and such.
I was sure in one sequence when Jason Fleming was like having a fight, I was pretty sure he was in like a pair of black khakis underneath his like armor, because I saw like back pockets on the back of the trousers.
Medieval beer is well known for its medieval propensity of back pocket,
back bum pocket on the jean, you know.
But generally speaking, I have no idea on clothing. I have a very scant knowledge on armor and swords.
We're treading water so much. We said this. It, like, the first Ali Tally that's going to be non-gunned is going to be hilarious. And like, I'm loving it. One thing I will mention, and it always gets me in medieval, like any sort of period piece. How fucking well lit rooms are by candlelight. So I text Matt when I was watching. I said, they must have those radioactive candles that like light the whole room. And it reminded me, you remember when Wolf Hall came out, when the BBC did that, and they used to my knowledge anyway, period lighting, and people were going, you can't see anything.
Yeah, people didn't say that about Kubrick, did they?
I know. You know. Yeah.
Barry Lyndon, you're like, can't see anything.
Can't see fuck all. Like, I remember there being like a big Mail article going like, people up in arms, you can't see anything in Wolf Hall. And then loads of historians are coming out being like, well, yeah, because like candles aren't that powerful back in the day. Like, what can you do? You
know? Well,
it's just interesting.
There you go. That was the candle tally. And
I've got more.
Carry on. Do carry on, Rob.
I've got a few more. I like the siege tower. It's cool to see one of them.
That was cool, yeah. That's the trebuchets and stuff, they were cool.
Yeah. I like the mini trebuchet they make out of bits of wood. God knows how they did that.
I would have liked a real like 18 montage of them doing that. That would have been sick.
Yeah. Brian Cox just like with a pipe in his mouth or something.
He's like, I love it when a plan comes together.
That was really cool. But I
when plans come together. one must celebrate.
when God has thy divine plan, it is a gratuitous day. Like, Christ, why are we doing like bad LARPing talk? They don't even do that in the movie. I like that.
Oh, God.
I loved how, like, when I don't know what they were that they were flinging at them, but like when the fire bombs went off, I was like, fucking hell, they had like...
Oh, yeah, like Greek fire pots and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, they went up like Hiroshima bombs. It was great. That's a cliche. Did, yeah. I loved it.
It is. Oh, I've got some tropes if you want some tropes.
Can we have a sneaky covert trope tally in this week? That'd be nice.
Let's go for it. We got the neglected wife, played by Kate Mara.
Yes, yes.
We've got PTSD Templar.
yes. He's seen some shit in the Crusades.
Yes. There's moments where he's middle distancing and it's like, damn.
Yeah.
He's seen some serious Saracen stuff.
We just couldn't instill religion with swords and it didn't go to plan. I'm so fucking angry.
I like how he realizes, like, oh, even when you're doing it for God, it's not that great. That's literally one of the lines.
War's bad. Oh, no. Yeah. Who knew?
We've got a young, inexperienced squire. We've got Jason's character not trusting Purfoy's character.
Yeah.
But we miss out on they grudgingly, you know, come to respect one another in battle. They don't do that. Mm-hmm. So we missed on that trope, sadly. We've got time jump explained by the narrator.
Yeah, we do. We get that.
We got Purfoy saving the squire at the last minute, and then he goes one-to-one with a baddie at the end of the film.
Yeah, he comes out and he's like half dead. He just gets up and starts. Yeah. He
does that Leroy twice. Jenkins he does him. That in the Leroy Jenkins. That's what he's doing with that horse and the flail.
Leroy, it literally is.
Jenkins in it.
Knights Templar.
Oh my word. And then he kills the baddie at the end with a broken sword, just like Kevin Costner in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
He does, yeah. That's a trope, broken swords. Still being useful.
Oh, and the relief army arrives just in the nick of time.
Yeah.
Which that never happened, spoilers. Yeah. We'll talk more about that at the end of the show.
The French prince is going to be the future king of England. Oh, I don't know my kings or whatever, so I don't know who he's meant to be. But he doesn't even get a line. He just nods. He just nods.
Spoilers, but he was never king. That's why.
Oh, okay. Oh, fair enough.
I realise we've gotten this deep into the film without even explaining what the film's about. We've done the classic FOF thing where we've not explained what the film is about.
No, I did it. I mentioned it in the retro review. That's fine.
Someone else explained the film for us.
10 years ago.
The Empire. Was. Thank you, Empire. Just before we forget again. Basic plot of the film is King John returns to take revenge.
Wars, King John, he's returned.
Yeah. This is just imagine the blue scroll.
speak. No, sorry.
I think
you'll find Rochester Castle quite operational.
Oh my god, you did this last night, and it exactly. the Baron d'Aubigny is looking to prevent the king from spreading north and taking London and getting a foothold again, which kind of historically correct. Was the point. So as you mentioned earlier as well, at the beginning of the show, I think the retro review actually did mention this, that there were a lot more guys than like the 20 guys that are in there.
Yeah.
You're looking at like probably 200.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
So you've got men-at-arms, archers, like just general foot soldiers.
They could have CGI'd a load of lads in and then just shot like close-ups of the ramparts with a few
It wouldn't have been hard to have some of the Dane extras as extras as well.
I said this.
An Attenborough's private army thing with
it. Yeah, just do that. Yeah. You could make 50 men look like 100 if you were savvy with editing.
Totally. We'll talk about the actual, the travesty of the ending of the film later, I'm sure, because it takes a real left turn on the old historical accuracy front.
Oh, yeah.
I think on that note, we should do favourite scenes.
Favourite scenes.
Hello, I'm Al Murray, and you're listening to Fighting on Film, the world's number one war film podcast.
My favourite scene is when Brian Cox gets flung against the castle wall.
It's so funny. I went back and I rewound that about 10 times.
Oh my God, Rob.
Because it was so funny. I wanted to work out when he stopped being a person. When it
stopped being Brian
dummy.
Cox. I think as soon as he was attached to the trebuchet.
You know what I mean? Like, I love the cut.
And when his arms got cut off, Brian Cox.
It was, they didn't hack his arms off. Yeah. Brian Cox is there in every interview trying to hide his nubs from Iron Cloud where he got fucking hacked to bits. Like, no. You know, he starts to be flung, and then he is flung, and he's getting like a limp dummy.
At what point does it become a dummy? Yeah.
It's like slapstick. It's hilarious.
The way it just hits the wall, and it leaves like a blood splatter, and it slides down.
It's gratuitous for like no reason.
It's insane. And the amazing thing about that is, Daubeny wasn't tortured or killed at the siege. He lived another 30 years. He was taken prisoner. He didn't die.
Famously, Albany's, surviving family walked out the premiere in 2011. No, like Zulu. They couldn't believe the treatment of a wool baron. They couldn't believe how he was treated. The man supplied wool for millennia. How dare
he? Wasn't a wool merchant either.
Was he not? Oh, okay.
No.
Paul Giamatti as King John told me that. I took that at face value.
Well, you know, that performance is, you know, you buy into that performance. Giamatti really sells it to you.
It's great. I love it.
Yeah. What's your favourite scene?
Talking about that, my favourite scene is one of Giamatti's scenes. And there's a reason for it. So Giamatti is torturing the people who are left, and he cuts the hands off the guys, and everyone's, you know, the Vikings are baying for blood. The Danes, sorry, they might as well be Vikings, is what they're sort of going for, aren't they?
In fact, they weren't Danes.
They weren't Danes either. Jesus Christ. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Right.
It's weird because they're all like depicted as like, I think they're speaking Hungarian at some point. And it's like, they're all like looking like Vikings. But at the time, I think he mainly hired like Dutch or Flemish and Spanish mercenaries.
But you could just change that on the day. Like, it doesn't just change it in ADR, it doesn't matter.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
Oh my God, it still would have been bad because it wouldn't look nothing like Danish, Flemish mercenaries, but it doesn't matter. Favourite scene. So, Giamatti is telling, Albany and Giamatti are having a row before, you know, he gets flung at the wall.
Yeah, a big confrontation.
Yeah, Giamatti just goes on this outburst, this rant. And I think it's up there some of the best angry acting scenes, like in like Pacino in Heat, where he loses it. And
oh, it's
Bruno
definitely
Gans.
From the Pacino school of angry acting.
But like Bruno Ganzi, downfally, and he gets some great lines. So he's like, "You cry for the common man, and in the same breath curse the crown that protects him." And he's like, "I have the blood. I am God's right hand, and you will never dictate to me how I am to be a king." And it's just like, it's so like over the top, like angry and spite-filled. And I end up actually siding with King John because I'm like, actually, he's the only person in the entire fucking movie that has any conviction or skin in the game.
Gives it a bit of passion.
Because this really feeds into my final thoughts, where the movie hasn't done enough to justify to you why Albany's fight is just, why the Magna Carta is important. It just assumes the audience is going to know.
Yeah. Nine people out of 10 aren't going to know what the Magna Carta actually includes.
No.
It's the basis of common law, et cetera. And, you know, that people are not going to know the significance.
Three-line intro.
Give enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. And that's why I liked Giamatti's scene, because at least you get explained why King John's doing what he's doing, whether it's right or wrong in the terms of the film. At least he gets his, and he gets more moments where he's talking to Tiberius about why this is and why it's important and why I need to take the castle. You get more of it.
There's that good scene where he talks about his father.
Like, yeah.
Cutting the finger off the serving girl.
He gets characterization that no one else gets.
No, it's
and
one
I
of
find
the,
that
the failures
so
of the film.
Weird, yeah. Mm. But no, it's that scene's on. If you don't watch the movie, that scene's on YouTube. Just go and watch it. It's great. Albany and Cox have got a great. I wish there'd been more scenes with them together.
Yeah, The cinematography is good. I like the angles that they go for in certain, you know, aspects of the film. There's some really nice shots in there, it has to be said.
It's competently shot. Like, there's not,
yeah,
like, I think editing wise is it dated very badly in the terms of how you shoot.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, those combat scenes, it's very smash cut, very quick.
Yeah,
you can't really see a great deal of what's going on.
Yeah, there's never a wide shot, because I think if you'd have done that, you'd have shown how sparse the defenses were.
It's like the Bourne movies or the Taken movies era of like editing, where it's all very close, very rapid cuts moving around and stuff, shaky cam,
disorientating, trying to not really so you don't know what's going on. And I guess it's trying to echo like franticness of hand to hand combat and how close up it is, but there's only so many like shots of guys swinging swords you can have. And I know you could say that about there's only so many shots of guys firing weapons you can have, but with a firefight you can bring
it
out.
There's only one shot of Mackenzie Cook firing a longbow.
Yeah, that's so bad, and that's weird to me as well.
It is, isn't it?
You get him loosing an arrow and it's the same shot five times in a row.
Oh yeah, I know.
And it made the final cut, and I just think, okay, did you not have as many shots of that happening that you wanted?
Apparently not.
It's a bit weird to me.
Yeah. I swear that's the one that they use at the in the first assault as well. So they film one shot of him loosing an arrow.
Mm. Yeah. And then he's dead. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know.
I think I read actually, and I was quite surprised they didn't use this, the one person they did execute was an archer. And he'd been in the king's service for a long, long time, but had switched sides.
Well, they could have had that in there.
Yeah, it would have made total sense, but yeah, they didn't include that.
So maybe we should slide into final thoughts like we always do.
I think we're getting there.
We're getting there. So it starts off a little bit like Lord of the Ringsy, Magnificent Seven-y, getting your gang together. And then it goes into The Last Stand.
Yeah. That's a good way of characterising it.
Yeah, that's what I got from it. Like, you've got the wide shots of them traveling on their horses, and that reminded me of when the Fellowship are going up to find
Monty Python, Holy Grail,
Lithamir, wherever it's bloody called. I haven't seen Lord of the Rings in yet. Middle Earth. I wish we'd had, because there's a nucleus of a decent film in here. There's parts that really work.
Oh, totally.
Yeah, I think I said to Matt off mic that it's not a film that's greater of the sum of its parts, but some of its parts, SOM, are decent. Like, I think, and I wish we had more setting the scene, setting the politics up of the era, like why this is important, why the Magna Carta was important, why John's, what John's doing is wrong, and, you know, maybe a bit more of Cox's character setting his army up, and, you know, us and them type thing. You never really feel anyone's got enough skin in the game apart from John, because he gets so much characterization and no one else gets it.
I agree. They rely heavily on that scene where the priest at the temple is traveling with is killed, just to set up Giamatti as a bad guy
so quickly.
So that grated on me. I that kind of like set me up to you know, be concerned going forward throughout the film. Because it just felt so unlikely. You know, there's these three Templars are traveling. They stop at, I think they're on pilgrimage. They stop at a castle.
Yeah.
And John arrives. And obviously the Templars had sided with the Barons initially. During the first conflict. And then Giamatti basically hangs the constable of the castle, and then cuts the tongue out of the priest. And Purfoy and two
nameless Templars
go down to sort of like intervene. Purfoy like grabs the stricken priest, throws him on a horse, they ride out, which seems completely unlikely. There would have been more men outside. He wouldn't have gone away. Then, as soon as he's left, the two Templars are completely overrun, and they've just died for no reason. The priest dies anyway, and Purfoy just carries on. He's like, oh, don't know what to do now. There's a, the, there's a number of aspects of this where it's like, that doesn't really work. Like, there's the whole love subplot with Kate Mara.
Oh, God, yeah.
And Purfoy's character, which is unnecessary. I know why it's in there.
And it drags the film on about half an hour more than
it needs. Will he break his vow of chastity?
Yeah.
And Mara's character is doing like a proper biblical Eve. Like,
yes,
role,
it is, isn't
she? Like, with the temptation and stuff. And it's very, I don't know, it's just not necessary, really.
Yeah, because in all those sequences, I was like, this could have been trimmed down or cut entirely, and you could use this time to, or the money that you spent in these sequences to make the film more grand.
Yeah.
You know, rain.
Or we could have had Mara talking to her lady in waiting about the siege and giving context around the siege. Like, we're really running out of food. There's a lot of people dying.
And I never like saying that.
Yeah.
We need more exposition than we get. And I don't know how you felt, but I also feel, because there's so many great character actors in this doing a really good job with what they've got, because the script isn't strong, as strong as it could be, there doesn't feel like there's a real lead to the film. I never felt anyone you could really pin your hat and go, that's your lead there. Purfoy hasn't got enough lines. Cox hasn't got enough lines. Everyone's sort of trying to lift it together, and I didn't feel like I could pin the movie on anybody.
Yeah.
It's probably a bad way to explain it, but it didn't sit well with me.
It does feel like the script is the element that is, you know, what's letting it down, because there is money there. They have, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, gone to this expense of setting up an actual mock castle, you know, filming it. They've done some good CGI.
All the elements are there.
Elements are there. I mean, they don't include like the actual city of Rochester, so the castle's just like on a plane. Not an aeroplane, on like a
It might have been
plane,
nice to have plane. Them in Rochester trying to inspire like an uprising, and
there's no context around the area and why they're doing it. Because there's a little bit of setup where it talks about it's a strategic point, but like, is it really strategic? And even Tiberius says, could we not just go around them? And John has a diatribe and explains it all, and that's pretty good. But at the same time, the film then forgets to set up the fact that they're undermining the castle's walls as well.
Yeah, they show it once, don't they? And they put the pigs in there.
Yeah, that took like a month to dig.
Yeah,
it could. But they could have easily like had
half hour.
Yeah, you could have easily had, you know, King John, just be like, begin a mine.
Yeah,
and you cut some dudes like digging, and then half an hour later,
meeting in his big tent with all his lads, being like, right, this is how we're going to do it.
There's no real men at arms. He would have had his own men at arms. He would have had his own entourage. Would have had, you know, loyal barons, loyal lords, loyal men at arms, knights would have been with him. You don't see any of those because it's just him and Tiberius the mercenary. So it kind of makes John seem like this really insular person where it's just him and a mercenary. He's got nothing but these mercenaries.
Yeah.
Which isn't really the case.
A nine men scene where they explain how much ammo they've got.
Yeah.
How many arrows they have, how many swords.
Yeah.
What they're going to do. Like, it just needs more of that. Yeah, it just needs a little bit more, because I never felt like they were besieged.
Actually, I like the bit where Purfoy takes command, walks around, goes like, where's the water come from? How much food have we got?
That's it. That's all you get of that, though.
Yeah.
And then how many men have you got left? Sorry. Go on.
No, exactly. And, you know, obviously there is a dozen men and the seven that arrive.
Yeah, that number fluctuates as the movie goes on.
Yeah,
whenever
it
they
does, because like
have
five of them die in the first 5 minutes of the assault.
They go, oh, how many more have you got left, Garrison? Like, man, oh, I've got six left. But then in the scene, there'll be like four or five over here, four or five over there. And I'm like, well, I don't buy anyway that these amount of men could hold against this huge army. It's just not doable.
Well, I mean, you take the 200 and totally. Believable.
Well, of course, yeah. But you need the money to show that. That's an issue.
Yeah, you can defend Rochester Castle with 200, because they did for 2 months. And, you know, and at that point, it was the largest siege England had ever seen.
Wow.
It was the most complex, you know, in terms of trebuchets, siege engine, undermining. That's really complex siege work. Because it's a really well-built castle. Giamatti has like a really nice line, like, you know, you don't have to tell me. I appreciate the strength of a Norman Keep. It's like one of his good lines.
He has some of the best lines. He feels like the most well-rounded character.
He is. That's why.
Exactly.
That's the nature.
And that's literally my final thoughts in a nutshell. Like, your villain is your strongest character, and that sometimes isn't a good thing because it shows the movie up.
What struck me is, you know, going back to the one word reviews and, you know, interactions on Twitter, someone mentioned that they learned history from it that they wouldn't have, you know, ordinarily learned. And that is something that we always talk about on the show, where it's like, people will learn something from this.
Yeah.
Even if it's only loosely based. And then they go away and you know, read the Wikipedia article. Oh God. Or go and read a book or, you know, dig a bit deeper.
Go visit the castle itself.
Exactly. Yeah. In this case,
it feeds
definitely
back into the grand sphere of history and learning, and that's great. And if the movie does that, then it's a triumph in a respect.
But the history at the end of the film is absolute shit. It's like the worst possible ending to this film. Up until the point where the Danes kind of sneak into the castle, which I don't think that's how they got in. Or whatever. It's okay. It's doing what it can with what it's got.
The
actual like story of the siege is insane because, you know, they fall back from the actual Bailey, the walls. They're in the keep. They fight on in the keep for another month. The corner of the keep collapses when the undermining of the tower brings that down. We talked about the CGI being, you know, the best representation of that we're ever going to get, but what they kind of allude to ever so slightly is that there is a huge separating wall that splits the keep in half that they just retreat behind and continue fighting for another, you know, couple of weeks. As it stands, like, the actual siege and the story of the siege is way more interesting than the film, as always.
Yes,
but then the outcome, it shows the siege as a defeat for John, which it wasn't.
No.
He successfully captured that castle and held it. It shows him, you know, off dying of dysentery, looking sad on a horse, while a wagon's stuck in some mud.
That didn't happen for another like 18 right months.
Like, that is it.
He looked hungover. French, lucky that a rough night.
He probably did. He's probably just sick of having to carry the film in terms of script. But the French, the relieving French army with Charles Dance at the head of it, didn't arrive, didn't happen, wasn't a thing. It's definitely not that siege. The fighting continued for another like year, 18 months. John finally died in Norfolk of dysentery, did die of dysentery in Norfolk.
From bad... mead or bad like beer or something, I heard
something like that. They don't really know for sure. So there's lots of like ideas about how it happened.
Don't have a photo,
whether it was poison
or
not. Yeah, there was no video of it, Rob. It's not there with the VHS.
No, I was live tweeting VCR. Tim John's death back then.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, like, it completely misrepresents, you know, John's fate, the fate of the barons, because Henry III came to the throne, you know, with a protectorate, and the barons basically decide, we'd rather have a weak young boy king than a strong French prince become our king.
It's nice to see xenophobia even back then. England.
Well, you don't want, you know, more French people coming
over here. More French, Christ! How many
taking,
wars we
taking
had
the crown?
Them? Isn't it?
I already had the Normans, but you know, it's interesting that the film's doing all right until the last like 50 minutes, and then it takes such a hard left turn into just
it does. It felt like they wanted to wrap stuff. It up. It just felt like it needed. It does. It just trails off. His film really front ended.
Oh, and Derek Jacobi as Cornhill, he didn't hang himself.
Yeah, it was weird.
Yeah. Because he had to do that because everyone had to die because John was shown as such a, you know, raging, menacing,
a real
brutal
sheet.
King.
Yeah.
That there's no way no one in that would survive. But during the actual siege, one of John's nobles supporters, or I think one of the mercenaries perhaps, even said, we should keep these guys as hostages, which was a very common thing in the medieval period. And that'll ensure that, you know, the sieges of our castles or towns or whatever that happen, they won't massacre the garrisons there. Right. So there was a logic to him, you know, keeping the garrison that survived alive. But we, you know, you just can't do that with the way that John's been characterized in the film.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Just a bit.
Yeah. It just peters out the film. It's so, as I just said, it's so front-ended with all those action-y, the fight sequences and the
It ends on that classic baddie versus the protagonist, doesn't it? And yeah. He can't fight John, so he has to fight Tiberius.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, if he'd have fought John, that would have been amazing. I'd love to have seen that. Paul Giamatti and Purfoy going at it. That would have been great. But he has to fight, like, not being horrible, the actor, but sort of generic underling baddie henchman number one. He doesn't have enough to do. This comes back to my core argument that no one has enough to do. And it's unfair to the cast because they are good. They're a good cast.
Yeah.
And the elevator, to me, is a pretty poor script. But there we have it, I think.
We've done our first Chivalry and Swords film justice.
I hope we have.
Botched our history too much or, you know, gotten particular types of sword wrong, because I know there's people out there that are knowledgeable on that sort of thing.
We swerve talking about makes of swords. We were quite clever, you know. And for the record, Smith & Wesson didn't make swords, and Kalashnikov didn't make swords. I was just being facetious.
It was a little fun joke there from Rob.
a little weapons-based chat, weapon-based wit for you there. So on another, you know, milestone for the show, it's not quite 150 episodes yet, but it is our first Chivalry and Swords movie.
Yeah.
We will endeavour to do a few more here and there.
We definitely will.
If you have any more suggestions, please come at us on the social medias at fightingonfilm.com, where you can find us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, find us on Instagram. Give us a follow.
Threads, if anyone's on
there.
We're
on everything. We're covering all angles.
Yeah. And you can also find us in person next week at the We Have Ways Festival, where we'll be giving a talk about the British Army during World War II on film, which is going to be a lot of fun. And hopefully some of you guys might be attending. If so, come say hello.
Yeah, please do. And keep it all things off for your war movie reviews. And we'll be back next week with another one for your delectation. Catch you next week, guys. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.